And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. We have a fair show for you this evening. How do you like that, a fair show? In a few moments, we have astronomy clip from Andy Fleming, Exoplanets in Multiple Star Systems. Our guest for the show this evening is Dr. Rita Louise. She is entertaining and she has some great ideas. Should be a great show. For those of you who have been emailing me, I apologize. I've been pretty busy lately. And for the regular listeners, you know that I like short and sweet emails because my eyes seem to glaze over after about two paragraphs. It's something to do with ADD. Some people say, I think I have separation anxiety with my attention deficit disorder. I'm not sure. Anyway, I got some emails about last week's guest regression hypnosis session and his claiming to have had past lives. I had a number of people email me about that. Well, I decided that if we do live multiple lives, I'm pretty much done. I'm too tired to do this again. Well, enough goofing around. A couple of stories. SpaceX is currently docked with the International Space Station, and I am loving it. I think the world of Elon Musk, and I really like, the things that he tries, and he just keeps going. He almost had to close the doors at Tesla Motor Cars, but kept going, and now it's a great success. And he's a real pioneer in privatizing space. And check out this great, awesome interactive website. It's in our show notes at podcastufo.com. And the SpaceX Dragon website's there, and it's interactive. You got to check it out. Our regulars also know that I steal the news from our Facebook page, and Peggy Shunning, she admins it. She's always digging up great stuff. The next story I want to talk about is Canadian witnesses see a UFO at 400 feet. There's a great picture, again, on our website. And you always see these pictures of UFOs and they're blurry. And this one's like really, really clear. And but one of our past guests jumped on our Facebook page and he chimed in saying basically that he thinks it's a drone. And, even though MUFON is investigating it as a UFO and all that, I tend to think he's probably right. Check out the picture and make up your own mind. And we also have a link to the story, and our source for that story is the Huffington Post. And now it's time for Andy Fleming's turn on exoplanets and multiple star systems.
And hi, Martin and listeners. Now then, science fiction has long depicted the idea of alien life on planets in multiple star systems. Just cast your mind back to Star Wars and Tatooine. And yet, until recently, mainstream science speculated that planets in such systems were nearly impossible. If they formed at all, they would be ejected due to complex gravitational interactions. Now, our Sun, of course, is a single star. But astronomers have known for decades that most stars in our galaxy are in multiple star systems, perhaps containing one, two, or even more stars. Amazingly, it turns out through astronomical observations that planets are present in these complex systems too. For starters, there are circumbinary planetary systems, of which 17 have so far been discovered. Now, the stars here are in close orbit, with the planets actually orbiting outside. And I suppose, in a way, these are the gravitational equivalent of a single star. More difficult for planetary formation are wide binary systems, where planets orbit one main star, the other star maintaining an orbit much further out. Now, the gravitational interactions here are chaotic, and in simulations, planets which aren't tightly orbiting a star are ejected from the system. Such a scenario may well be present in the constellation of Cygnus, with star HD188753. A pair of stars are in a wide but tightly bound binary arrangement here, with a sun-mass star. A planet closely orbits the primary star, but all other planets were most likely ejected from the system. A further major discovery occurred in 2012, when a planet was found around Alpha Centauri B, part of the triple star system next door to our solar system. Next, PH1 was the first quadruple star system to be discovered to have a planet. Finally, Kepler-47 turns out to be a multi-star, multi-planet system. Two stars orbit one another every 7 days. Here, the gas giant Kepler-47c orbits the stars every 300 days and is even located within the habitable zone. But how about this? In 2011, the Kepler-16 system was found to have a Saturn-mass circumbinary planet in the habitable zone that astronomers call a real Tatooine. And why not? Now, such discoveries raise the exciting prospect that additional planets may exist in the Alpha Centauri system. They could orbit Alpha Centauri A or Alpha Centauri B individually, or be on large orbits around the binary Alpha Centauri AB. Since both the principal stars are fairly similar to our Sun, astronomers have been using various radial velocity or star transit methods to look for planets in a star system just 4.3 light years away.
Well, I can't imagine that. You know, I'm confused enough with just one Sun. You wouldn't be using a sundial, I guess, on that. Well, don't forget to jump in the chat room on podcastufo.com. It's a 1-2-click sign-in, and you can ask our guests tonight some questions. And now for our guest, best-selling author Dr. Rita Louise. She's the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. Did I say that right? Maybe I did. And she's also the host of Just Energy Radio. Hi, Dr. Rita. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us. And you, you're a best-selling author, and you have done some work on some ancient ideas. And I remember when we had talked briefly before, I guess a book was based that you wrote on how it could be possible that certain ideas came up in different areas that are totally isolated. Do I have that basically right?
Correct. I mean, in my book, Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods, what it does is it looks at mythology. And one of the things that we did in writing the book was made sure, I mean, we were looking for a global narrative. We weren't looking for a Egyptian story or a Sumerian story or a Mayan story. We were looking for stories that were found around the globe where we would find the same story narrative and then use that as material for this book. Because when we started comparing and looking at this mythic legend, you know, our history, our creation, what we found was that there really was one story being told, and it was the same story virtually around the world.
I've actually thought of that subject a number of times. You know, briefly, I didn't dwell on it enough to write anything about it or whatever, but I've always wondered how, like, an idea comes to mind in one area. I mean, something even simple, like the yes and no is typically the same, you know, the shaking of the head, worldwide in every culture. And it's funny how also there is God worship in all these cultures found, whether it's, many gods or one god. you know, it is kind of really strange how these traditions just seem to pop up and on an isolated island where there couldn't be contact, outside contact.
And I don't think they just popped up. I feel that there are, you know, two potential answers to really who we are, you know, in today's day and age, because there is so much stuff that we learn that's cultural, you know, not having anything to do with school, but our thoughts and beliefs and what's right and what's wrong, that is just part of our initiation into humanity. That, you know, either goes back so far into antiquity, which I believe there's a lot of it that does. But I believe that there was, you know, definitely an extraterrestrial influence into the history of the Earth. I'm not even going to say just mankind, but the history of the Earth. And it is through their influence that many of the things that we have learned, experienced, and explored came into being.
You know, a lot of times you don't really think about this, but when you think the Earth is 4.3 billion years old, I mean, it's just a number. But when you really look at the span of time that is, you know, so many things could be here and disappear and without a trace. For instance, and I was reading somewhere where another, I know it sounds like a long time, but it really isn't in the scope of things. Another 30 million years, there'll be no sign of the pyramids. They'll be completely gone. And that's something you would just expect to stay forever, you know? Mm-hmm. So when you're talking, you know, 4 billion years, to get your head around that number and how much time that truly is, you know, there could be other civilizations that popped up or visited, or you know, I'm open-minded to those possibilities.
And you know, when we went into writing this book, we really, I mean, it was kind of funny. We did a lot of talking in the garage. That was kind of like, well, actually, we called it the vortex, because you'd go in, you thought you'd talk for 10 minutes, and you know, 2 or 3 hours later, you'd walk out, and it's like, wow, it's been 2 or 3 hours. And there was a whole lot of conversation about where the book should come from, because we were both very hesitant to just throw the whole extraterrestrial, you know, ancient alien thing on the table. You know, and it's not that we were trying to disprove it or we were trying to prove it. But when it really came down to it, when I started to physically write, you know, moved out of the researching phase, moved out of the rough organization phase, and started putting, you know, pen to paper, there was no way to get around what mythology suggested without going there, period, because it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense to talk about these races of gods that are having these wars, and there are these gods that are humanoid, but they're not human. You know, they're described as half men, half snakes. I mean, excuse me, not human, at least not any humans I've ever met. You know, and how do you take all of this material that, again, you know, going on the basis that we're looking for consistency worldwide, so you have this a worldwide belief in these half men, half snake, half reptile people. What do you do with that?
Well, give us some examples, if you would, in particular what you're just talking about now, and the two different regions that would be supposedly untouched from each other or unconnected. Can you give some examples of that?
Well, I mean, probably the most the best known example is the Noah story. And I'm sure everyone listening knows about Noah and the ark and the animals going on the boat, and it's him and his wife and his kids, and, you know, they survived the storm. They could go watch the movie if they're not sure. Anyway, I had heard years and years and years and years ago that there were like 250 flood stories on the Earth. And in my research, I have found other people that have suggested that there are 500 or 600 flood stories on the planet. My going into the research, I just assumed that in the Amazon, you know, the Amazon flooded and you would hear this story about their plight. But let me even bring it more down to home. So my bathroom is on the second floor. And so let's say I turn the water on to, you know, fill the tub and the doorbell rings and I go downstairs and I answer the door. And now the tub is overflowing everywhere. And the next thing I know is that there's plaster falling down from my ceiling and it hits my little dog on the head and it knocks her out. And there's water all over my sofa. You know, that's my flood story, you mm-hmm. know, and every time someone asks, well, what happened? That's going to be my story. So let's say at your house, you have a hot water heater that's in the garage. And in your garage, you have, you know, a bunch of books and papers and things that you really don't want to get wet, but they're in your garage anyway. And now the hot water heater blows and there's water, you know, an inch of water all over your garage floor. And it soaks up into all of your cardboard boxes and it kind of wrecks all of the stuff in your garage. That's going to be your flood story. And the story you tell is going to be vastly different from the story that I tell about my flood. Wouldn't you say?
Have you been reading my Facebook page? No, I do. I actually do have a flood story.
Oh, well, then what's your flood story? Come on.
Oh, no. I just bought a property that has it's a great old conference center. It's not really that old, but it was built with flat roofs, and in New England, you just don't do that. And so I actually had a swimming pool. I put one of those kiddie swimming pools in the middle of the grand salon to let the water from the ceiling drip into it. So, yeah. And it's been trying.
But your flood story is different from my flood story, which is different than the hot water heater in the garage flood story, which is going to be different than the hurricane or whatever, the storm that hit the East Coast and the people that lived there. There's going to be individual stories and there's going to be a regional story, you know, or Southeast Asia. So, you know, they're all inherently different. But when you start reading the mythology, what you find, and I mean, this blew me away. And I'm being pretty inclusive with what I'm going to say. There was a righteous, pious, or virtuous man who was warned of an impending flood. He built a boat, an ark, dug a canoe, climbed a tree, climbed on a leaf, climbed to the top of a mountain. He survived the flood with his sister, his wife. There might have been a few children. There might be like an old man involved in it. And if some of the stories, animals get on the boat. In some of the stories, animals climb to the top of the mountain, if the animals are mentioned at all. In a few stories, which were very geographically dispersed, so it was like one in Mesoamerica, one in the Middle East, you know, but only a few, an animal is released to let them know that the waters recede. And that's it. I mean, all of the stories have pretty much the same set of events with the same number of people that survive, and that's it. You don't find, you know, and the ceiling tiles fell down and hit her dog in the head. I mean, you don't find that.
So it's a lot of similarity in the story.
It's beyond similarities. I mean, they're almost word for word. I mean, with variation. So as an example, this is one of my favorite ones. This is out of Peru. It talks about these two righteous brothers who were farming, and one of their llama came up and told them that there was going to be a flood. So the brothers take their wives and their children, and they climb to the top of a mountain. So when they get to the top of the mountain, there are some animals on the top of the mountain. And so as the waters rise, the mountain, the level of the mountain goes up, and as the waters recede, the level of the mountain go down, and they survive the flood. So, I mean, you know, there's different pieces, but, you know, in a bigger picture, it's pretty much the same story.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about also those, I don't necessarily want to say artifacts, but aren't there like cave drawings that are very similar in different parts of the world that could have never been connected?
I mean, there's so much stuff. I mean, with what we did, we really looked at the mythological record, because by the time we started documenting things, it was already very late in the story. I mean, mankind wasn't created until like the second to last chapter of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that is exactly true. I mean, just from my other research, you know, we find images that are very similar. We find construction techniques that are very similar. We find graphic images. Actually, I was working on this today, and I'm hoping I can actually get it to the release place. Is a video called Icon, the Deconstructing of the Archetypes of Our Ancestors, which is a video. And one of the things it looks at is it more from our history from an artistic point of view and the parallels that we find in art, you know, cave art, other mm-hmm. art, different architectural styles, you know, like the megalithic construction. I mean, I don't mm-hmm. know if you saw on Facebook, I think everyone or your listeners would be familiar with the wall in Peru, Sacsayhuaman, where it's those giant boulders that just fit together like right. puzzle pieces. Mm-hmm. I just saw one report that it looks they think they found a similar construction in Russia. I just interviewed someone on my show, Just Energy Radio, that were talking about same kind of megalithic construction in Australia. You know, so it's wow. coming up all over the place.
Wow. And there's no it's just another one of those mysteries. Just, you know, this show is basically based on UFOs and sightings and all that. But, you know, this sort of all ties in. And while I'm basically mentioning this, what are your thoughts on today's UFOs?
Well, you know, I go back and forth. I mean, I am not an experiencer, so I can't, you know, speak from that perspective. From my, you know, reading of the mythology, there is so much beyond belief material that comes from the mythological record that supports claims made by contemporary UFOlogists. It's not funny. I mean, I do an entire presentation about alien agenda and underground bases because there are just too many parallels. You know, and so based on, you know, I do ghost hunting, you know, so I believe in ghosts. And just based on the amount of information and evidence that's out there, even though I haven't experienced a UFO, I feel like I'd be kind of hypocritical to say I don't believe in them. I mean, I know we're not alone. And I know that they were here in our past. And so why should they not be around now? That just doesn't make sense.
I totally understand what you're saying there. On the message board, someone wants to know how you think basically the pyramids were constructed. Have you looked into that or have any thoughts on that in particular?
There are so many different theories about how the pyramids were constructed. I think anything that comes out of mainstream science, you need to just put to the side. I mean, I do believe that there was some kind of advanced technology that had to have been employed to move those stones into place. I believe mm-hmm. that they are much, much older than the 2500 BC that, you know, they try to place them at.
I agree with you on that one.
And I think, you know, Robert Bouval and Graham Hancock try to say that they're 13,000 years old. Maybe. I think they might be older than that. You know, back also with the Sphinx, I think that's also, you know, minimally, you know, 13,000 years old. I think they could be older.
Yeah, I mean, there's really no way to actually date, for one thing. There's no way to date stone. There are ways to date, say, pottery and other, you know, things like that, as far as when it was fired and radiocarbon dating. But when it comes to stone, you know, I'm in the fine arts and antiques, and sometimes in antiquities you can get fooled because you can't figure out how old a stone is.
mm-hmm.
So well, they're just grasping at dates because, you know, the found objects inside when they were occupied, you know, so you're right. They could be at any age, really.
Well, but I think also there is this basis that came out in the 1600s by James Usher, who, dealing with the Bible, took all of the dates, you know, like Adam and Eve begot Cain and Abel, and they lived for so many years, and they begot that, and, you know, and they took all of these dates, and he went back in time and identified that creation happened in 4004 BC. Now, I think, you know, in conventional wisdom, we all realize that creation didn't happen in 4004 BC, but I don't think that science has necessarily gotten that memo, and they're still trying to place everything in that antiquated timeline that just doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, and I know I watched a documentary about the, and someone is mentioning it now on the message board, about the Sphinx that seems to show signs of water or other type of erosion on it, and which would bring it way back as far as dates go.
I've interviewed Robert Schock several times, and we've had a couple of juicy conversations about it. One of the things that he says is that they would have to be minimally built before 7500 BC, you know, because that's when it really dried up in the Sahara. You know, the comment that I made to him was, why would a group of engineers who were smart enough to carve the Sphinx out of rock, you know, and make something so beautiful in a desert area, carve it below the level of the ground,
yeah,
so that every other day you had to sweep it out?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have
never
a
thought
water,
of that, but yeah.
Well, that, you know, when I'm on air, sometimes stuff just comes to me, and then it just comes out of my mouth, and we both kind of laughed, and he went, you know, you're right. Why would they? You know, if it was water runoff, I'm sure they, you know, they had the technology to make a certain gradient on the stone so that the water would just run off. But sand, not so much. I mean, how many times has that thing been filled in and different, you know, pharaohs or Napoleon or whoever have gone in and dug it back out?
Now, the Ice Age, I wonder if that affected that. That must have affected that particular area as far as at least water. I'm not sure of the climate back then. And that was, what, 10,000 years ago?
I mean, that's when it pretty much ended, was,
oh, that's right,
11,500 yeah. BC, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
10,000 BC. I mean, because there was, you know, when all of the large mammals died, you know, the...
Right. The big sloths and the mammoths,
right,
and...
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was about 10,000 BC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but there was just like a flash freeze.
Right. Yeah, all of a sudden they're all just... I know they found... I think it was in Colorado they found some amazing fossils all right next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, another true mystery. So getting back to, let's get back to humans, okay, and the extraterrestrial. So do you have a thoughts that we were seeded here, or what's your thoughts on that?
I mean, my belief, or, you know, based on my reading, I believe that the extraterrestrials actually came here at some point, and I'm not saying a specific group because I believe there were multiple groups, but they came here and actually terraformed the planet. I mean, that's what I have been led to believe from reading the mythology. So we're talking, you know, 3.8 billion years ago, they were here terraforming. As far as dealing with humanity, I mean, I don't think they seeded us here, but I think they have been directly linked to the evolution of life on the planet. And when it comes to humanity, you know, starting with like the Australopithecines, I think their hand had been directly into our DNA, manipulating it all the time to where we are now.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Because, now you got me curious, because...
Well, there's no real because, you know, I always think of how a new species all of a sudden appears on the planet, you know, like an unknown species found right where it should be easily found. You know, that's always been a curiosity of mine. You know, you read about, I'm not saying like on the bottom of the ocean or in the rainforest or something like that, but say there's just like this animal or amphibian or something like that, and it's, you know, it's just like a new species, you know, discovered. You know, how does that happen?
We no. just didn't look hard enough. I don't know.
It could be. Or,
I mean, I don't know if they just like magically appeared out of thin air. I don't know.
Yeah. Go into a little bit about terraforming. Someone is on the message board. What is the overall theory of that?
Well, and it's a little bit sketchy because the material that we were working with is a little bit thin. But there were just things, and actually I'm going to start in a different spot. When you start reading the mythology, you know, a big chunk of the storylines talk about a world where these progenitor gods come to in their what I call the cosmic egg. And there are these eight progenitor gods. And they set up, their shop or whatever. And it's a world that is half dark, or it's a world that's in darkness. And while they're there, there's a rebellion that happens, and that world is destroyed. And the other group, the ones that were the rebels, take off and start what I'm going to call a new colony. Now, I have to say is I'm taking a whole bunch of myths and kind of stringing together a storyline, and somebody reading the book Man-Made might come up with a different storyline, but this is the one that seems congruent to me. Or at least the one that I'm sharing today. Well, one of the things that we saw was that we believe that where they first went to was Mars. And ask me why Mars?
We were just typing that on the message board. Someone had just said at some point in the future they want to terraform Mars, and I said maybe they already did and it's a failed project.
Well, actually, yes. You know, one of the things that scientists have identified is that within the first, and I think it's the first 2 million years of Mars's development, they moved into the Nokian period where there was water and the beginning of an atmosphere on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And then they entered into the late heavy bombardment period, and that's when their the magneto, the you know, mm-hmm. the spinning inside of Mars basically got messed up and they started to lose their atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's interesting is that, so they talk about this rebellion that happens, you know, and I'm kind of using that word. So 3.8 billion years ago, so that was about 4.2 billion years ago. So then 3.8 billion years ago, the first signs of life were found, you know, that's where they date the first blue-green algae on the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it wasn't much after that that Mars went totally dead. Okay.
Right.
Now, one of the other things is that one of the first things that happened on the Earth was the development of this blue-green algae. And it created iron oxide, ochre.
Mm-hmm.
And with the water, and if there was blue-green algae on Mars, they would have also created ochre. And, you know, they say that there wasn't any life on Mars and there was no atmosphere on Mars, except Mars has that red color because it's covered with iron oxide.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't have iron oxide if you don't have oxygen.
Right.
Oh! And the only way that you can, you know, one of the main ways in antiquity that formed was from this blue-green algae absorbing the carbon dioxide from the water and emitting oxygen and it binding with the iron in the water. You know, and so it was more out of kind of this propensity of circumstances. When you read Vedic texts, they talk about these two guys at the end of the last I think it was the Kalpa Yuga. So, you know, we have different cycles of time. And one of the bigger cycles of time, you know, there are the day and the night of Brahma. And so on the last day of Brahma, these two guys stole the Vedas. Well, the Vedas were the information about creation, and they took off with them. So that story ties in with that rebel story that I was talking about. You know, there's a lot of consistencies that it seems to be that they stole technology, took it to this other place, and they set up shop there. And so, you know, again, you have to just look at this stuff and go with the coincidences. I'm sounding really flaky. I'm sorry.
No, you're not. Not at all. Not at all. One of the things also is not so much where, you know, people are seeing the face on Mars and things like that. I mean, nothing to do with that, but you would think that, I mean, I truly believe that there was at least some form of life on Mars at one time before, like what you said, the magnetosphere stopped and, you know, the atmosphere went away and everything had to die. But I just think that the rover should be able to find life and, you know, not to sound conspiratorial or, anyway, but if they did find it, would they tell us right away? You know, I don't know.
Well, I think that they tend to land those rovers in probably some of the most inconvenient places. you know, it's like, I don't know, if I was going to Mars, I would go to Cydonia and try to get pictures of the faces. I mean, come on, you know, why send it to some crater somewhere? Okay, so this might sound kind of weird, but one of the things that I thought when they first started sending those rovers up there and they kept crashing and blowing up as they were coming down was that perhaps there's still life on Mars underground or somewhere and they don't want us to land and they're taking them out.
Well, I think if there was life under, I don't know about the life underground, what would be the reason to be there and how could you survive and all that, you know, I mean, of course I'm thinking in a human terms, but anyway, that's still an interesting concept. But I don't know if there could have ever been intelligent life there or not, but there are some intriguing things. And if you look online, a lot of times you will see strange images, even pictures that the rovers have taken of things that are, you know, almost, too good to be true, you know, look like a door handle or a baby shoe or, you know, there's all kinds of weird, a squirrel. I remember seeing that. And, you know, maybe it is just rock formations, but it really gets your mind thinking, that's for sure.
No, I agree. I definitely agree. And then I saw on TV the other day that, you know, and it was just a commercial and I sort of half paid attention to it, about some group of like four guys that are going to be going to Mars. And I don't know what the details, and I'm assuming it wasn't a NASA mission.
Wow.
But yeah, but it was just like this past weekend, and I wish I had paid a little bit more attention to it, but it was a commercial. So, you know, it was part of that like flip, 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 push the button, get through the commercial thing. Mm-hmm.
They're going to make a reality show out of it?
I think so, to be honest with you.
Jeez. Wow. Here's a thought someone posted on the message board, which, you know, may or may not actually be true. I think he did it kind of as a joke, but he says they wouldn't tell us if they found life on Mars because that would end the funding for the Mars program and the mystery would be solved, jobs would be lost. And, you know, I know that sounds, it was meant as a joke, but there could be a lot of truth to that, you know, not exactly that, but, you know, there could be a little bit of half-truth to that.
I mean, if they find life on Mars, then some of the other things that have been said about life, you know, there's this giant dichotomy that's going on. There are scientists that are finding, you know, planets around other stars that look like they're in the habitable zone. And so there's all of this information coming out that, yes, it's very possible that we're not alone. And then on the other hand, there's a lot of pressure, maybe is the right word, about, well, but you're not supposed to look at it, you know, and mm-hmm. the whole thing of the government covering it up. I mean, I do think the government's covering it up, and I think they've been covering it up for a long time.
Yeah, I talk about that a lot in the show, and, you know, I think that it is very possible that there is some part of the government and, you know, maybe a need-to-know type of situation. And, however, you know, we talk about Roswell a lot and you know, the very obvious cover-up with that. It's just you wonder how, you know, as time progresses, what part of the government would know about it and what, you know, is it all need to know? Is it just a very small compartmentalized section that deals with it? What are your thoughts on that?
I don't really have a thought on that. I mean, my feeling is, you know, if it's need to know, we already all know. We all know. You know, we've seen the X-Files and we've seen all the shows. And so why does it need to be a big secret anymore, other than they've been lying to us for so long? I feel like that's the bigger secret, the lies.
Well, absolutely. No. I mean, they would have a lot of splaining to do. That's for sure.
You know, and then I've heard, you know, the commentary, which I could totally believe, about the back engineering of technology and the whole financial piece of not wanting that technology to get into somebody else's hands from the monetary point of view. You know, it always comes down to money.
Oh, it always does. Everything does. And, yeah, you know, like fiber optics, that's a good example. You know, something was written, you know, years ago about a found craft, and they were describing in different words exactly what fiber optics was, you know, and I think that's a pretty good, you know, it's not evidence, but it's an idea that it's a possibility that that's reverse engineering right there.
Mm-hmm. I always like throwing out Velcro. You know, I heard that a long time ago, and I'm like, yeah, Velcro.
I heard the guy that invented that had armed guards around that invention or something like that. This is when I was a little kid. But you know how those stories float.
Uh-huh.
So,
but it seems like, you know, from the point of Roswell, things have just moved forward exponentially in the area of electronics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm trying to think of when we had our, like, first computers. And did they have computers in World War II?
They had very rudimentary, very, very, you know, I don't know exactly what they were. And I don't think in the 40s, I'm thinking later. So, you know, there may be a connection there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, like I can't think of the name, you know, the encryption boxes, you know, and stuff, but I don't really think they had electronics. Heck, they barely had TV sets, and they weren't even color.
And now it's growing leaps and bounds. You know, it's just amazing where it'll go. And you know, that's a lot of times when people question the fact that it is totally physically impossible for another civilization from another solar system to visit us. You know, basically, if you can just look at what's happened to our technology in the last even, you know, 25 years, then you should be able to envision that, you know, that someone's going to figure it out eventually on space travel.
Well, and, you know, based on the dynamics and importance in their culture, you know, they might have gone down a different evolutionary, scientific, I don't mean physical evolutionary, but scientific path. You know, I was listening to, I think it was Rush Limbaugh. I don't remember. Not that I totally hate Rush. I appreciate him more now than I did 10 years ago. But I think it was his show or one of those AM radio shows. And they had this scientist on talking about life in outer space. And they were talking, you're going to laugh. And they were talking about the possibility of life being on Europa. Mm-hmm. You know, the icy world.
Right.
and that there might be these aquatic, intelligent aquatic animals, and they were kind of likening them to dolphins, you know, mm-hmm. on that planet that existed under the water, which, fine.
Under the ice.
Mm-hmm. Under the ice. And the comment that the person made was, it still makes me laugh thinking about it today. Well, if they were intelligent, they still couldn't be under the water, because how could they make, you know, PC boards and electronics, because it wouldn't function under the water? I'm like, who are you, and what dummy tank did you come out of? I mean, really?
Yeah. Yep.
Anyway, it just amazes me. But, you know, those are the people that, you know, are getting airtime. I don't get it. On nationwide radio.
Yep. Yep. That's right. Yep. No, you know, I mean, that Europa is really quite an amazing moon when you think about it. It could be thermal. Actually warm water under the ice, or when I say warm water, you know, way above freezing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's the number one ingredient you need is water for life. It's very possible. Mm-hmm. I hope we actually go there and visit it and drill the 2 miles down and send a probe down in there and check it out.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. So, have you written other books besides this one we've been talking about?
Yeah, I've written 3 other books. The book that I wrote prior to Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods, was entitled Dark Angels, An Insider's Guide to Ghost Spirits and Attached Entities. And it looks at ghosts, spirits, and attached entities. Wow, that was pretty easy. You know, and it's a really fun book. I talk about different topics. I talk about the concept of attached entities, which is a pretty interesting, scary topic. But the information in there is illustrated through my personal stories, you know, and I didn't really mean for it to be this kind of like autobiographical thing, but it just kind of ended up that way. But it's pretty fun because, from what I've been told, it's like hanging out with me and I'm just sitting there telling you stories in my fun and witty way, because it was pretty unedited. Mm-hmm. I mean, edited for grammar, but not edited for my personality coming out in the book. How's that? Mm-hmm. Then the book before that was called Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4, and it looks at the mind-body connection and discusses how and why we get sick. Looking at it from a, you know, I'm going to say metaphysical perspective, it goes into the aura and chakras and subtle bodies and talks about the movement of subtle energy through the bodies into the physical body and why imbalances to the flow of subtle energy can create illness. And then what you can do to make yourself well again. To avoid the cosmic 2x4. Yes, sir.
You lost me at your third book, Chakra, somewhere. Sorry.
Okay. So are you not familiar with the concept of chakras?
Not really, no. But I don't want to, you know, drag our listeners into that.
Okay.
Into that. You know, the main reason I wanted you on the show was your last book, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And how has that sold? Has that done well?
It's done well, and actually it was picked up by a mainstream publisher and is being re-released in October under the title E.T. Chronicles. You know, so if people are interested in getting a first edition with the original title, because basically there are 2 additional paragraphs in the new book and maybe a few less spelling mistakes. and there is no difference between the, you know, this title and the one that's coming out, other than the name. And, yeah, you know, but one of the other things that I would like to share is I have, a YouTube channel, called, Science and Spirit Meet. And one of the things that I've been doing over the last year or so is producing these little, video magazines and covering different topics. And so I have, one that talks about who are the authors of myth. Another one that talks about genetic engineering in antiquity. There are a variety of different topics that I've covered, you know, reincarnation. I mean, they pretty much cross the gamut of alternative thought, but there are quite a few that really talk about the ancient alien question. One talking about the Nephilim, which is probably my most popular one, where I had to turn the comments off because I was getting pretty slammed. But it's really good. You know, people either really like it or really hate it.
That's just like art, they say. It'll move you one way or the other. Either you love it or you hate it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. Going back to ghosts, I know this is a UFO show, but you know that's a subject has fascinated me. And a lot of times there are people who claim that there's areas where they see ghosts, they see Bigfoot, they see UFOs and all that. In your research in the ghosts and spirits and all that, did you find any of this to be true, or at least that there was an area that seemed to be more active than other areas?
Okay, great question. You know, it's interesting because I think that all three groups that you just mentioned all kind of conglomerate around the same kinds of energy. And when we start talking about areas where we have ley lines and things like that, areas that are considered sacred space, we tend to find that there are more sightings of ghosts. There are, you know, if the situation is correct, more sightings of Bigfoot and UFOs, you know. And I think it's an energy thing. You know, usually if you have ley lines, there are energy vortexes. And so what's going on the planet tends to be amplified. And so I think that they all kind of come together in those areas.
That's interesting. Last week we had a guest on that was talking about a place called Brown Mountain down in North Carolina. And that was almost identical to what he was saying. You know, he believed that there was a high energy field in that area, and there was someone doing like energy work that you could actually see something when they took photographs and all that. And there's like a sighting, a constant sighting going on there of UFOs and abductions. And I know you touched briefly that you have never been an experiencer or anything like that, but have you ever actually looked into or talked to anyone about the abduction phenomena?
I mean, obviously with the show, I've interviewed a number of different people, you know, that have been experiencers or write about that topic. You know, it's kind of scary to me.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I guess it's scary to the people that are experiencing it, too.
I mean, if it's true and it really does happen, I can't even imagine what it would be like. I mean, like the worst nightmare you could imagine, really.
But what's even worse than that is that if you have an experience where you saw a ghost in your house, you can go to your friends and say, I think I saw a ghost and I'm scared. You know, can you really go to your friends and say, I think I was abducted and I'm scared?
Hmm.
You know, so I feel really for those individuals because there's this huge sense of isolation that comes along with it.
Right.
And social stigma.
A few people that I've talked to that claim this has happened to them and talk to them quietly, you know, are like suffering about it. You know, I talked to one guy that I didn't really believe. Because he seemed like he was looking to talk about it a little too much, you know, get up in front of people and talk about it. But this one woman I talked to very quietly about it, I mean, she was in pain talking about it, and it made it much more believable to me.
Well, and I think people that have those experiences, I don't know, my experience has been more working, and I'm going to kind of shift the focus here a second, is with people that have what's called an attached entity. And it's basically a ghost that can control and manipulate your energy. Now, whether it is actually a departed person or we're talking about some kind of an alien that's taking on humanoid form, is it, you know, we can get into a totally different conversation. But anyway, when I have individuals who come to me and say, I have an attached entity, usually I'm like, no, you don't, you know, because they just think they do. And it's the people that tend to be much more humble about it are the ones that you really need to listen to, because those are the ones that it probably is a fact.
Yep, I agree 100%. Exactly. Yeah. We're getting toward the end of the show here, and I'm just going to look to see if we have any more questions up on our... Okay, we do have one question here. The guest has mentioned energy-mind connections. I wonder what her thoughts are on remote viewing, whether that's real or not.
100% real. I mean, if you are doing any kind of psychic reading, you know, if you're doing a relationship reading and I'm talking to you and I'm talking to you about your boyfriend or girlfriend who might be at home, you're now doing remote viewing. I mean, that's a very simplistic example of it. But I think I believe that we all have psychic abilities, and I believe that we all remote view and we just don't realize it.
Mm-hmm. I was on a live radio show, maybe about a year ago, and the guy, kind of as a joke, he said, "All right, now we're doing our remote viewing." He said, "I have something on my desk, and I'm looking at it right now. What is it?" And I said, the first thing that came to my mind, I said, "It looks like a turtle."
Okay, that's really weird, because I'm going, it's like a frog.
And he said, well, he said, actually, it's a hard hat. And he says, you just won. But it's kind of funny. I've seen people that have like intuitive thoughts, and, you know, I know someone that does, and I'll be darned, a lot of times she's right. You know, she'll just come out and say something, and next thing you know, it's like, wow, how the heck did she know that? It's interesting. Okay, you know, that's going to be it for our show tonight. And thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Yes.
Can I do a shout-out to my webpage?
You certainly can.
So if people want to get some more information about my work or purchase any of my books, they can go to www.soulhealer.com or www.ritalouise.com. And that's kind of like the portal to the new redesigned websites.
All right.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for the show today. If you missed any part of the show, you can catch it as a podcast and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on our website, which is podcastufo.com. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show today. Our guest, of course, Dr. Rita Louise, Keith Rowland, producer for the Dark Matter Radio Network, Andy Fleming for the astronomy news, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for the music, Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. We have over 9,000 likes on that now due to her. And don't forget to like us on our Facebook page. You can check us out live next week right here at the Dark Matter Radio Network and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And don't forget to jump in the chat room. This is Martin Willis reminding you to keep your eyes to the sky.